You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Confirmation hearings for CIA Director nominee John Brennan begin this afternoon against a firestorm of criticism about the Obama administration's targeted killing program. Mr. Brennan is one of its key architects. We know much more about that program thanks to the release this week of a 16-page Justice Department white paper which outlines the legal case for drone strikes against Americans. And joining us now for a look at the legal basis of the policy is Karen Greenberg, the director of Fordham Law School's Center on National Security. Welcome back to our show.
Thank you for having me back.
Notre Dame professor Mary Ellen O'Connell wrote in an op-ed piece in today's New York Times. She said, the white paper's sweeping claims of executive power are audacious. What do you make of the document? Is it audacious?
It is pretty brazen in terms of its claims both to executive power and to its rereading of sort of what the government can do against a U.S. citizen. So it's not audacious in the sense that we've been prepared for this for a long time. This is not that different from the speeches that high government officials, including Eric Holder, have given in the past about the drone program and specifically about the targeting of Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen that was the target of a drone strike, and that is the subject of the white paper.
Also, his 16-year-old son was killed.
Yes.
That was in separate drone
strikes.
Yes,
it was separate. That was a couple of weeks later, and it was the same time that Samir Khan, yet another American citizen, was taken out by a drone strike.
Has any evidence been released to the public about terror plots that Anwar al-Awlaki and his son were planning or were engaged in?
You know, that's actually a really interesting question that you raise. No, but Anwar al-Awlaki's involvement with a number of other terrorist plots, including that of the underwear bomber, the Christmas Day aborted bombing of the airline over Detroit, I believe it was, in 2009, or Chicago. And he was tied to Major Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter. He's been tied to numerous plots, both inside court and in the headlines and the newspapers. The question was, and this memo raises the question of imminence. Was there an imminent attack that he was involved in that would have resulted in an attack against the United States? And what this memo basically does is to redefine the concept of imminence by making it much broader. They're not alleging that there was an actual plot. They are not alleging that they interrupted something in the process of happening. They are alleging that his very existence and his involvement with al-Qaeda and the network he was involved with and the capabilities that he could have had could have led to an imminent attack. And I think this is what many people in the legal and policy communities are concerned about in this particular white paper.
So there's no ticking time bomb in these situations.
No, there isn't. And one of the things that I think is perhaps most disturbing in a way about the white paper is that it's in this context that it invokes the 9/11 tragedy. It's in that part of the memo that's talking about this expanded notion of imminence basically claims that if we had used this concept earlier, perhaps we could have prevented 9/11. So to me, that's the most audacious part of the memo, actually.
Had they been indicted for any crimes?
No, Anwar al-Awlaki had not been indicted. There had been talk about trying to put together an indictment, but he had not been indicted.
Now, would it have been different if he weren't an American citizen?
Well, it depends on who you talk to in terms of how you want to think about due process considerations and due process rights. But there is a distinction between targeting an enemy that you're defining an enemy in a foreign country and targeting an American citizen. So let me give you an example. They could have said that he had, in effect, renounced his citizenship. They didn't do that. They didn't go that far. This is the lawyers and the government. They instead said, you know, this is an American citizen who has allied with the enemy, and therefore we have the right to attack him. If you look at what's happened with a sort of parallel process, which is the detention process, you'll see that there is a huge distinction between an American citizen and a non-American citizen. There are no American citizens held at Guantanamo Bay. So, yes, there is a distinction for all intents and purposes in this particular context. And it's one of the things that's most important about this memo. It's about two things at the same time. One is the drone strike program used for targeted killings against members of al-Qaeda and associated forces. And the other is the targeting of an American citizen. And I think this latter has hit a sensitive spot in the American public in a way that the generalized drone program has not. And I think that's rather interesting.
White House spokesman Jay Carney said, "I would point you to the ample judicial precedent for the idea that someone who takes up arms against the United States in a war against the United States is an enemy and therefore could be targeted accordingly." Doesn't he have a point because Awlaki joined al-Qaeda?
Yeah, but again, you want some kind of process and some kind of legitimacy and some kind of oversight when you're determining who is going to be on what we now popularly call a kill list. And particularly when it's an American citizen, Americans are going to want to know just how that came about. And they can curtail it and they can justify it all the ways they want. But the fact is that without due process, without judicial review afterwards, there is no room for any kind of review of this decision. And I think that is particularly disturbing because, of course, the administration is going to say, well, this will never extend into other kinds of alleged wartime criminality, et cetera. But we don't have any guarantees of that. And one of the reasons we don't have any guarantees is we, the American public, do not know the process. We do not know the criteria upon which this was made. And we do not know the limits that have been drawn around it. So, for example, could it be used in subsequent times as a precedent for other kinds of enemies, let's say cyber enemies? And so I think it is worrisome, and it is opening a Pandora's box of concerns, and I think that's appropriate.
Have they cited any laws or precedents that would lead to this this conclusion that they can engage in these kinds of operations?
Well, basically, this is done under the authorization to use military force that came out just after 9/11.
And Congress gave the president, then President Bush, that right.
To use all necessary force, mm-hmm. necessary and appropriate force, to keep the United States safe. Again, this memo is done under the rubric of self-defense, this white paper that you've been referring to, under the rubric of self-defense. It is the authorization to use military force that has laid it's the foundational document in the targeted killings program. Now, what's most interesting about that is it's going to be interesting to see where the future of the authorization to use military force document lies. It's covered a host of activities for the past 11 years. But as the geographical breadth of the United States use of drone strikes increases, will we need a new authorization to use military force? And I think this is probably on the minds of a number of people in Washington.
Although in written response to questions from the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Mr. Brennan defended the program as legal, said that additional legislation is not necessary.
Right. And to the extent that they can keep saying that the authorization to use military force covers al-Qaeda and that these groups that we're attacking or these individuals that we're targeting in Africa and elsewhere are associated with al-Qaeda, then maybe that's true. If it goes outside of al-Qaeda strongholds and addresses other kinds of insurgencies, I'm not sure that's going to be the case. And also, remember, that is an answer to the targeted killings program, as opposed to the dimension here, which this white paper is about, which is the targeted killing of an American citizen. That is a rereading of the law and of due process and judicial process. And so, you know, that's another part of the question that actually needs to be answered still.
Well, aren't there laws prohibiting assassinations?
Yes, there are.
So
the administration has been quite averse to, does not want the term assassination used just for that reason.
So, in effect, they're saying that in this case, executive power supersedes the courts and Congress?
In this case, actually what they're saying, that would be a way of interpreting it in a way that was unkind to the administration. I think that what they would say is they can read the law, they can twist the law in such a way to make it look lawful based on precedent. And what's most concerning about that is this is essentially a covert activity, the use of drones to influence events in foreign countries at times in a non-acknowledged way. But, you know, it has much too much resonance with what happened with the torture memos. And I am not saying these are exact same things, but there was a sense that give government lawyers a conclusion that they need to come up with, they can figure out a way to do that. And that is extremely disturbing. And again, we're talking about the killing of an American citizen without due process.
Some people have said that the Obama administration's willingness to release the torture memos, but not the memos involved with this, is an example of hypocrisy.
Well, I think there's another issue going on here, and it has to do with what the administration is calling their need to protect foreign partners. That may or may not be the case, but it's hard to throw that out the window just without some consideration. So there may be another dimension, covert and covering up. Illegalities may be two very different things. But I think people are angered, and therefore you're getting a kind of response that is justified and in the wake of actually seeing the documents themselves. But, you know, they have given numerous speeches on this. They've released the white paper. They've released more documents last night. I think there's at least to a narrow audience. I think they'd like to be more transparent than they're comfortable being, and that's the dilemma that this administration has gotten itself into. They want to look like the good guys that are defending constitutional issues, but when it comes to things they want to do in the name of national security, they're willing to go into a gray area that can be questioned by lawyers.
Was there a legal reasoning behind the administration's decision up until now to not share its legal reasoning?
Not that I know of.
My guest is Karen Greenberg, the director of Fordham Law School's Center on National Security. Does the administration claim it can carry out these operations anywhere in the world, whether it's Somalia, Yemen, or Sweden, for that matter?
No, I don't think so. I think that's one of the concerns. I think, actually, if you look at the material we've been given, it's not about the ability to use drones worldwide. It's about the ability to use drones to kill enemies in places where al-Qaeda has established a stronghold. And again, I come back to the authorization to use military force. But under that, the United States is authorized to use force against al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and associated forces.
But the memo argues that we're fighting a transnational enemy. So in that case, wouldn't it make sense that these operations could be carried out anywhere? If al-Qaeda set up a command post in Sweden, why wouldn't that be a legitimate target under this kind of thinking?
It would be, but you would have to have an al-Qaeda network built up there. And I think that's just sometimes lost in the debate. But of course, theoretically, where al-Qaeda or, and I think this is the more problematic category, associated forces had established a stronghold or a presence, yes, then under this authorization and this reasoning, you could use the drones.
John Stewart joked last night that every so often we get a news report that the third in command of al-Qaeda has been killed through a drone strike. Do we know what criteria the administration use when determining what a senior al-Qaeda official is?
No, we don't know, and it's something that people would like to know. We don't know the process by which these determinations are made, the kind of intelligence that it's based upon, who actually is making the decision along the way, who reviews the decision, whether or not there's any kind of pushback against it. We don't know anything about it, and I think it is one of the very valid points about this policy in general.
Now, a lot of different groups have taken on the name al-Qaeda. It's not the same thing as what we were facing after 9/11. So if I start a little group calling it Al-Qaeda Brooklyn, does that put me in danger?
Well, I think there have been maybe two or three iterations of Al-Qaeda since 9/11. Right now, we're in a situation where there are Al-Qaeda groups, Al-Qaeda-esque groups, growing in places throughout Africa, in the places you've mentioned,
like
for
Mali.
Example. Like Mali, like Somalia. And the real question is, why are we calling them Al-Qaeda? When I look at it, it looks as if it's because they share a narrative with Al-Qaeda. They are committed to violence. They are committed to violence, sometimes anti-Western violence, but not always. Sometimes it's really just against the powers that be in their own state. I think you're raising a very valid point. What does it take to be considered a member of Al-Qaeda? Which, of course, raises the very uncomfortable question, which is, because we are legally, the United States is legally authorized only to go after Al-Qaeda and associated forces, to what extent are we trying to fit these enemies, who we're calling enemies, into an Al-Qaeda rubric? And how are we doing that? Is it because of a narrative? Is it because of ties that we haven't been told about? Or what is it exactly?
Does the memo address capturing suspected terrorists who are U.S. citizens instead of launching a drone strike against them?
It does it in an oblique way. The white paper mentions it in terms of the inability of the United States, the infeasibility of capturing these individuals, either because of the countries they're in, because of the strongholds they're in terms of their in terms of Al-Qaeda or whoever is protecting them. But again, that is one of the issues that has experts most perplexed about this white paper and most concerned, which is that what does it mean not to be able to capture somebody? There has been a tremendous decrease in captives over the past couple of years. And one can only wonder, looking at our detention policy and how it's gone awry since the opening of Guantanamo, our inability to get anybody through a military commissions process, even the 9/11 suspects who are now awaiting trial amidst tremendous hurdles. There's just a sense of, is the United States killing its supposed enemies because it's just too intractable a problem to detain them and try them? And would it expand our category of indefinite detention, which is already so much of a problem, both on the Hill and throughout the executive? So I think there are huge issues here that are philosophical and deeply and profound when it comes to understanding how a democracy operates.
If you capture a suspected terrorist, there's a good chance you'll get some important intelligence. And we're missing out on that possibility.
Well, that's actually a wonderful point. When you think about Anwar al-Awlaki, the American citizen who was targeted and killed, and about whom this white paper was written, you really have to wonder what kind of information he in particular had about the nexus between Al-Qaeda Central, or Al-Qaeda Diffuse, however you want to define it these days, and the United States. He was considered a point person between Al-Qaeda and the United States. And the kind of information he had, we don't have. And so I think it's not that everybody who's killed has tremendous information, just like everybody who we put in Guantanamo didn't necessarily have much valuable information. But there are those individuals who, by virtue of killing them, the United States may lose much intelligence that could prove helpful in keeping us safe.
You mentioned that it's hard to figure out what much of this memo means. That's because it's written in a passive voice?
Did I say it was hard to understand what it
meant? Well, it does come across as kind of oblique at times. It almost sounds like there's an attempt to fudge.
I think what there is an attempt to get to a certain bottom line. And the bottom line is that lawyers are going to authorize the killing of a U.S. citizen. So I think that may be what you're reading into it. In fact, in some ways, it's a little more user-friendly than some more legalistic memos, because it'll often put, like, in parentheses, which part of a legal precedent they want to emphasize. So, I mean, I didn't find it trying to fudge things. I found that it was, in a way, an attempt to explain a policy that they knew would be highly controversial.
After the fact or before they started implementing it?
Well, in terms of the American citizen, I'm assuming it was before the fact, and that's what the reports are. In terms of the program itself and what other memos may cover that, I think you'll probably find that there's a trail of memos both before and after.
Last year, Mr. Brennan said in a speech at the Woodrow Wilson Center that there's nothing in international law that bans the use of remotely piloted aircraft for this purpose or that prohibits us from using lethal force against our enemies outside of an active battlefield. What does international law say about targeted killing then?
Targeted killing, and this is pointed out in the white paper itself, has to follow certain laws of war, and that's what Mr. Brennan was referring to, and that's why this memo is argued the way it is memoed. So there are issues that have to do with proportionality, distinction, imminence, and a concept that's mentioned in this white paper, which is humanity. So in other words, all of those concepts taken together really mean that there has to be wise judgment used in terms of avoiding civilian casualties, knowing who you're targeting, doing this in a humane way that spares as many lives as possible, etc., in that realm. And those are the kinds of laws of war. Mr. Brennan has said that the targeted killings don't violate that. But again, we know very little about what's happening with these predator strikes. The reports that come out of Pakistan and some of the foreign press and the reports that exist in the United States are often very different in terms of how many civilians were killed, which civilians were killed, how many leaders of al-Qaeda and associated forces were killed. It's hard to know what the facts are, and nobody outside of maybe the intelligence sphere and people with clearances in the government seem to know reliably what the facts and figures are about the drone program. So to go out on a limb and say it's not violating international law is a problem until we actually have an agreed-upon set of facts and figures.
We've been hearing from our listeners. George from Brooklyn wants to know if Lincoln had to get a judicial warrant to kill Confederate troops during the Civil War, weren't they U.S. citizens in U.S. territory?
Yes, they were, and I think the comparison with the Civil War is completely erroneous in this particular attempt, because we're not talking about two nations being at war with one another. We're talking about what both presidencies, both the Bush presidencies and the Obama presidencies, have said from the beginning is a paradigm of war that, because it is not between two nations, has different kinds of laws. And it's precisely in that gray area that much of this discussion of what we can do and what we can't do, what the United States can do and what it can't do, comes. And so while it is theoretically interesting, I think the fact that this is a transnational force that is not a state actor remains to this day as a distinguishing factor.
Ben from Park Slope writes on our show page, "I'm happier that drones are doing this reconnaissance and killing rather than invading nations as we did under Bush. Is this policy better than our more direct invasion approach during the last administration?"
I think in terms of saving American lives, yes, and that therefore you are going to find support for the targeted killing program and the use of drones. The real issue is going to come up in two separate ways. One is the what this is going to mean internationally. If, in fact, these are not as precise strikes as we know them to be, what is that going to mean in terms of the amount of enemies it's creating around the world when families and children are inadvertently killed? And until we know the answer to that question, it's really short-sighted to say, well, this is better, because you do have to think in terms of long-term repercussions. The other thing is what that listener did not mention is that part of this debate, and certainly the white paper, is about the killing of a U.S. citizen. And until you know the processes by which that determination was made and why it was infeasible to capture him, then it is hard to make the determination that it was better to give up on due process and judicial process than it was to kill him and to end the argument there.
Wasn't the white paper, which is causing such a big stir this week, sent to key congressional committees last year?
I think it was written for them. I'm not sure exactly which ones got it, but it was written for.
So why this uproar
committee now?
Is it because of the Brennan nomination?
Well, the uproar now is both because of the Brennan nomination and the fact that nobody in the public domain had it. It was leaked to NBC News early this week, and so nobody had it. All we had was the speeches of Harold Coe, legal advisor to the State Department, of Eric Holder, and of John Brennan himself. So it was, a documentary verification and somewhat more detailed than anything the American public had seen before. Of course, the Brennan nomination is rightly bringing this all to a head.
So if we have total transparency, let's say, will that affect anything?
Well, you're never going to have total transparency.
But you know what I mean. Let's say we've just recently had learned that the Bush administration involved 50 countries in the rendition program.
Right.
That's something we did not know for a long time. But if everything about this program was revealed, with a few names blacked out, of course, would that change anything? Congress has been eliminated from the process. The courts have been eliminated from the process. So does it really matter?
That's a good question. And I think it in terms of the American public and their perceptions, it might not matter. If everything were transparent, it might, however, completely transparent, it might affect our diplomatic relations. But I can't speak for the American public. In my opinion, it should matter. It should matter what processes are used, because you never know how widely or far they will be applied. And as much part of the problem with the targeted killing justifications is that it seems to rely upon what they call in the white paper knowledgeable, high-ranking officials' judgments and determinations. But that doesn't mean that there couldn't be knowledgeable, high-ranking officials who might want to expand the categories for targeted killings. And so the degree to which it relies on the just trust us, you don't need to trust any kind of limits, legal limits and legal boundaries, is deeply troubling.
If you were on the Senate committee, what questions would you ask Mr. Brennan about the program?
Well, I would probably ask him what he thought about the international repercussions of the drone program.
Have other countries responded?
Well, they haven't responded, to my knowledge, in any formal diplomatic ways, but you see it coming up in a number of, for example, in a number of jihadi sort of narrative about what now angers us about the United States, which would not be a reason to give in on those grounds, but you do need to know that there are people whose families have been killed, who feel like they're being targeted, who feel like they're living in tremendous fear, and who are not necessarily combatants of any sort. And so this is just a matter of time until it comes back to bite us. I would also ask him about, does he think the American public deserves some kind of additional transparency about due process when it comes to an American citizen? And is he content that the legal justifications and the legal processes for making that decision could survive outside of trusted officials. And what that means. In other words, do they understand that there could be another administration in there sometime? And maybe it would be people whose judgments they didn't agree with. Are there legal protections in there against the misuse of power in targeting American citizens? So, you know, those are among two of the questions. I would also ask him, as long as you had him there, does he think the authorization for the use of military force is going to survive into the future, and if so, how far, and what will happen if there's a determination that there are enemies of the character of a terrorist organization, but that are not al-Qaeda or associated forces, how he actually would define that. So I think there are a lot of good questions to ask.
Well, thank you for answering a lot of my questions. Karen Greenberg is the director of the Fordham Law School Center on National Security.